So after all of that was resolved, the prosecuting barrister then delivered his opening remarks. What did he have to say about the charges faced by Lisa Smith and the case that he intends to present to the court over the next weeks?
Well, the prosecuting barrister is Sean Galan, and from the outset, I suppose he gave the court a bit of a backgrounder on Lisa Smith. As we all know at this stage, she was a member of the Irish Defence Forces. We heard she served from 2001 to 2011. She joined when she was just 19 years of age, a Donegal woman, as you say. We heard that she converted to a Dundalk woman, rather. To Dundalk from County Louth. That's where she's from. We heard that she converted to Islam before she left the army. And in fact, we heard that she applied for permission to wear her hijab while on duty, but was refused. Mr. Galan said that she eventually applied for discharge from the army because she believed her role in it was in conflict with her new faith. Mr. Galan also gave the court a broad overview of ISIS, how it gained prominence in Iraq and Syria, especially in the wake of the Arab Spring. We heard about its caliph or leader, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, and how its followers pledged allegiance directly to him. Mr. Galan said this organization beheaded, burnt or buried alive those it considered to be apostates or who were members of other sects. In relation to Lisa, we heard that she went on the Hajj in 2012. This is a pilgrimage to Mecca in Saudi Arabia. It's a pilgrimage all Muslims must take at least once in their lifetime. We heard Lisa met an American man online who had converted to Islam. They kept in touch through Facebook for the next 3 years. And Mr. Galan said it was apparent from these communications that he mentored her on certain aspects of Islamic faith. He said that she discussed her wish to make hijra, which he explained was a call to followers to migrate to areas under ISIS control. He said this American man started a private Facebook group called We Are Here to Obey, that she became an administrator of that group. We heard about certain interactions that would be presented as evidence in this group, whereby Lisa is alleged to have expressed a desire to live under Sharia law. She also expressed her desire to die a martyr, apparently. We heard that she moved to Turkey in 2013 and then on to Syria. She stayed there for a number of weeks. We heard a witness will give evidence of her being overjoyed to be on Syrian soil and that she wanted to begin her jihad. This witness will also say that she was prepared to die. There was an awful lot of detail in Sean Galan's opening address, but again, it's important to point out that this is not evidence. This is simply a roadmap of the case that he plans to present over the coming weeks.
Now, Syria would have been at the height of its very bloody civil war when Lisa Smith travelled there in 2015. Did we hear anything about how she actually got there and what then she did while she was there?
Well, again, we heard that she had first visited Syria in 2013. She was there for a few weeks, having travelled there from Turkey, but no charges arise from that visit. But her subsequent journey to Syria, we heard, began in October of 2015. We heard that she lied to her family about where she was going. She booked a one-way flight to Turkey. She used cash to pay for it. And from there, she made her way across the border into an ISIS-controlled region of Syria. She spent months in a boarding house there. She divorced her first husband around this time. She had a daughter with the second man that she married, a UK man who had also converted to Islam. And by late 2017, ISIS was in retreat. Many of its strongholds had fallen. We heard Lisa was detained by Syrian forces in 2019. She was detained in a camp where she apparently gave certain information to the FBI and a journalist called Norma Costello. We all know she was repatriated to Ireland then in December of 2019. She was interviewed 11 times upon her return. She repeatedly denied joining the terrorist organization or doing anything to benefit it. We didn't hear an awful lot of detail about what Lisa's alleged to have gotten up to over that four-year period between 2015 and 2019. Again, this was just Mr. Galan's opening address. But essentially, his case is that membership of this organization can be inferred by conduct. And he says that by answering this religious call, he described that as a central act of allegiance to the Islamic State. He said this wouldn't have happened by accident. She sought to access ISIS-controlled territory, he said, and the means by which that could be done. And again, that line that you mentioned at the top of the piece, he said yesterday that she essentially enveloped herself in the black flag of ISIS. She remained there, she married there, and he also accused her of running with ISIS when it was in retreat. And he said that all of that was indicative of what he claims was her membership of this organization.
Now, a number of civilian witnesses were called to give evidence yesterday, including an old friend of Lisa Smith's. What did she have to say?
Yes, this was a woman called Una McCartney. They've known each other for over 20 years. And she said that Lisa wanted to go to places where people like her were. Those were her words yesterday when she was giving evidence. She said that she didn't know that Lisa wanted to go to Syria and that they didn't stay in touch after she left. She didn't even know she was going anywhere. She said that her daughter rang her to say that she saw Lisa getting on a bus with two suitcases. But that was the first she knew of her friend even leaving the country. She said that she tried to call her. She couldn't get through to her. She did the next day, at which point Lisa was at the airport. And she asked her where she was going, but she said that Lisa didn't tell her. And that was actually the last time they spoke. And she was cross-examined by Michael O'Higgins, Lisa's barrister, yesterday. And under his cross-examination, she was probed further about her friendship with Lisa. When they were younger, she said they enjoyed drinking and partying. She said they were a bit wild, like all young people are at that age. She said Lisa wasn't great with drink. She also described her, if she got something in her head, if she was interested in something, she said Lisa would go hell for leather on those things, but that interest would fizzle out. And she thought that would happen after she had turned to Islam too. She thought that she needed help or counseling at the time and that she was maybe looking for comfort or a sense of belonging. And Mr. O'Higgins asked her if she thought that her friend was naive. And in response to that question, she said she was very naive and that she could be easily taken in.
Can we go then to the material aspects of the case? The evidence provided by Mr. Lunny, obviously Mr. Justice Tony Hunt, very complimentary about the quality of his evidence, which was hugely significant both in the investigation and in the convictions. Can you remind us what he went through?
I will, and I'll do so through Kevin Lunny's own words from the stand, because as you say, Anton, his account of what happened to him was fully accepted by the judges yesterday. Unsurprisingly, he was one of the first witnesses called by the prosecution back in June. And I remember watching him closely as he made that short trip to the dock from the back of the courtroom, a short trip for you and I. But I wondered at the time if every step felt like a marathon for Mr. Lunny as he prepared to give his testimony. If he was nervous, he certainly didn't show it. And over the course of the next few hours, he gave a remarkable blow-by-blow account of what happened to him. He said that he stopped outside his house after returning home from work that evening because he noticed a light-coloured BMW parked in the laneway outside his home in County Fermanagh. As soon as he stopped, he said that car reversed at speed and smashed into his Land Cruiser. Two masked men then dragged him out of his car. Another masked man arrived on the scene at that point, forced him at knife point into the boot of a black Audi. His head was covered, so he couldn't see where he was going, and he was taken to a yard in County Cavan, some 40 or 45 minutes away from his home. He was taken into a steel container, which he believed to be a horse box. He was asked if he knew why he'd been taken there. He said no. He was told it was because of Quinn Industrial Holdings. He was told he had to resign. He was told the other directors had to step down too because they were destroying the company and jobs were at stake. That's what he was told. He said that he was told the other directors had to go too. He was told the court cases, both North and South, had to stop. And he was told that he'd been watched for 6 weeks. He said one of the men raised concerns about DNA. At that point, a knife was used to scrape under his fingernails to try and remove some DNA. He was worried that he was going to lose his fingers. He said they then decided to douse him in bleach. He was stripped. His hands were bound by his wrists with cable ties behind his back. He was knelt down on the floor. He was then left on his own with one of the men while the others went to procure a bottle of bleach. This was poured over him. The prosecuting barrister, Sean Guerin, in his opening address to the jurors back in June, described this as, or to the court back in June, described this as an attempt to cover their trail. He was then subjected to what could only be described as a savage beating. His leg was broken with a wooden bat, his face slashed with a Stanley blade. The letters QIH were carved into his chest, I suppose, as a reminder as to why he was brought there and what he had to do to ensure they didn't come back for him. He was eventually dumped on the side of a quiet country road, left only in his boxer shorts, and he managed to crawl on his hands and knees to a junction where a passerby thankfully spotted him and raised the alarm.
Five family members have been jailed for what Mr. Justice Paul McDermott described as the most profound breach of trust a human being can commit against their children. Newstalk's courts correspondent Frank Graney joins us to give us the background to this most horrific abuse case, while we also get reaction from the CEO of 1&4 Ireland, Maeve Lewis. Good morning and welcome to you both. Frank, first of all, give us the background to this case.
I will pass, but I'll tread very carefully because, as Mr. Justice McDermott said yesterday, this is a deeply distressing and very disturbing case. And that says a lot for a judge of his calibre who is well accustomed to listening to these types of cases. This goes back quite some time. 91 charges of the absolute worst sexual abuse, sexual exploitation and neglect were brought against the parents of the five children, their two uncles and an aunt. And after a 10-week trial that was heard in Croke Park before the Central Criminal Court that was sitting there due to the pandemic to allow for social distancing, such as, I suppose, the amount of lawyers and people involved in this case, it was held there. They were convicted of a whole multiple of charges, and they were handed sentences yesterday ranging from 15 years to 3 years. The father of the children got 15 years, the mother got 9 years, two uncles got 15 years each, and the aunt got 3 years. We heard some, just in relation to the neglect, we heard some very distressing details from the children themselves, from social workers, from teachers, school principals, neighbours. The judge described the house they lived in yesterday as filthy. The children were filthy. We heard from their foster parents. They've all since been taken into care. They were taken into care in 2016. And when they were taken to care, they didn't know how to use cutlery. They didn't know how to use toilet roll. They didn't know how to wash themselves. One of the social workers who gave evidence during the trial, I remember, shared a striking image with us when she gave her evidence. She said that she found just one bar of soap in the house. One bar of soap for a family of seven. No shower gels, no shampoo, no toothbrushes, no toilet roll. She said there were stains on the walls. They were painted over. There was rotten food all over the place, moldy food strewn all over the house, rubbish all over the house. The mother said that they had problems with rodents getting into the house, and she blamed a dodgy front door for that. But it's fair to say they would have found any means to get in. Such was, I suppose, the lure of the bounty that lay within. This social worker found nothing in the house to entertain the young kids, aside from a few broken toys. We heard there were numerous outbreaks of scabies in the home. They were malnourished, often beaten, completely starved of love and attention. They had medical problems too, such as lice, unexplained marks and scarring to their bodies. They were described by their foster parents as overcompliant, anxious and extremely sexualized when they were taken into care. And the allegations of sexual abuse, many of which the accused were convicted of following that trial, they only came to light after the children were taken to care and the foster parents reported seeing highly sexualized behavior in the children. We heard that the eldest boy confided in his foster parents during the summer of 2016. Tusla got involved, obviously, they were involved throughout. And when these allegations of sexual abuse were made, they referred the matter to the Gardaí, who then interviewed the eldest children. But these interviews didn't take place, we heard, until July 2017. That was some 9 months later. And when asked for an explanation as to why it took so long, we were told this was because the children weren't deemed fit for interview until then. And this was also how the other family members, the uncles and aunts, also came to be on the Garda's radar.
Mm. Now, a number of issues straight away come to mind. Were these children going to school? Did nobody report the condition of the children to the authorities at all? I mean, it seems extraordinary that this could be going on for so long without somebody somewhere intervening.
Yeah, and look, I think there are still an awful lot of unanswered questions in relation to this case. And these were possibly not questions for the jurors to answer during this criminal trial. There are, it has to be said, a few heroes in this story, teachers and social workers and whatnot. We heard in 2011 that two of the children attended a hospital appointment with their mother. Doctors were concerned by the appearance of the boy and the girl, and they described them in their evidence as dirty and grubby. And one of the heroes, an astute medic on duty that day, noticed that they were wearing inappropriate clothing for what was a hot day. This is very interesting. This doctor described them as being overdressed, clearly too warm for the weather outside. And upon further inspection, they discovered the kids both had very serious burns under the heavy clothing. That's how social services got involved in the first place. They engaged with the family over the course of the next few years. But we heard the parents would lie to them. They would try to deceive them. The social workers certainly didn't know the extent of the abuse. They did try their best to help them to take better care of the children. Obviously, taking children into state care is a last resort. And the parents did feign interest. They would try to do better for a time just to keep appearances up, it would seem, and keep the social workers at bay. We heard care packages were often provided to them, but they would go unopened and unused. Fast forward then to 2014, 3 years later, when the eldest son ran away from school one day, and another hero in this story, the principal, went after him, followed him home, and he said that he was horrified by what he saw. The house was upside down. He was very worried about how the kids were being looked after. He was the one who contacted TUSLA. He also spoke to the school psychologist. As it turns out, Gardaí had already contacted TUSLA after they found this boy on his own in a local park. We heard that he had soiled himself. He was in a very distressed state. TUSLA then visited the house. This was a very troubling visit. A number of other professionals got involved. All of them were very concerned about the children. They concluded that the children were at risk of neglect. The parents disagreed. And it was another 2 years then before the children were taken into care, which is remarkable when you consider that this family first came to the attention of TUSLA 5 years beforehand in 2011. And one of the social workers who gave evidence was pressed on that during the trial and did try to explain how long the process actually takes, in the sense that there would be 6 months between case conferences because plans would need to be put in place. And, you know, as I said, they would try to work with the family, and taking children to state care is always a last resort. And again, the parents did try to pull the wool over their eyes during their home
visits. Still, there are serious questions to be answered there, that these children were subject to more abuse. Now, admittedly, the sexual abuse didn't come to light until after the children were fostered. But still, I mean, there comes a time when the condition of children is so dire that at least on a temporary basis, you'd imagine that they'd be taken into to care, just to, you know, feed them up and clean them up, and then maybe have some interviews with them. But anyway, that's perhaps for another day. The extraordinary thing is that there was something about the mental competence of those accused, that they may not have been as intellectually developed as you might expect from adults. That's number one. And number two, it seems that they did plead their innocence all the way along. There was no guilty plea, and they didn't perhaps understand that what they were doing was wrong.
Yes. So in mitigation, I mean, they did obviously contest these charges, as is there and was their right. They were convicted by a jury of their peers, and we heard yesterday that they still don't accept the verdicts of the jury. They have shown no remorse for what they did. They don't accept any wrongdoing. Particularly interesting in relation to the mother's case, because we did hear that the mother made certain admissions during her Gardaí interviews, and she certainly resiled from them by the time that it came to trial. We did hear again in mitigation some evidence put forward that there were some intellectual difficulties, but Mr. Justice Paul McDermott certainly didn't mince his words yesterday. It took him some time to eventually hand down these sentences, these relatively lengthy sentences, I suppose, particularly in relation to the father and yeah. and the two uncles. But the judge did say that, you know, he noted the evidence in relation to their intellectual capabilities, but he said that he was very satisfied that they did know that what they were doing was wrong. They did know what they were doing was wrong. And that was really important, I suppose, because the claim was to the contrary, that given their intellectual difficulties, they didn't know what they were doing was wrong. And he proved that point by pointing to some evidence heard during the trial where social workers would visit the house. And again, the parents would be keeping up appearances. They would be making attempts to clean the house before they arrived. The mother would be showing her into bedrooms, you know, where there might be a duvet on a bed and the room might be a little bit better kept than other rooms. So the judge described that yesterday as an attempt to deceive the social workers. And with that in mind, clearly, if you're trying to cover up something, you know, you are aware that you're doing something wrong.